indication of fill, light, or anything like that.
No, the shadows are...
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was the technique of photography and outdoor scenes or extreme contrast scenes. Well, up until recently, was to give three times the amount of exposure it would be indicated,
mm-hmm.
and then use either shortened developer or very weak developer,
mm-hmm.
that developed into the shadows quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Winston's ever used water bath, but one technique is to immerse the film for 1 minute in the developer and then put it into a still bath of plain water,
mm-hmm.
for a minute, and back into the developer for a minute, then into the water bath for a minute. The idea being that it would continue to develop in the shadows, and the highlights would develop up to a certain point, and that would be the end of it because of the dilution of water.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the reason I ask is I think there's a really nice handling of a subject that might be a lot... The way it would be done today, I think, would mm-hmm. be much cruder in a way, and the range of tones wouldn't be as nice. And I suspect that if this photograph were taken today, and this is the Ray Carpenter picture, somebody would run out there with a Hasselblad and do some sync strobe, and it wouldn't be at all the same picture.
No, there'd be catch lights and things like that throughout it, and the people in the background wouldn't get enough light unless they use extension strobe.
Right.
But bear in mind that these were exposed and developed one at a time.
Right.
And that was the part of your technique of photography, was to learn to make a negative out of those sort of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just up to you to make a negative that could be printed.
Mm-hmm. Some of them, by the way, some of the negatives I've seen were failures in that respect, too.
Yes.
There were some that
mm-hmm.
were obviously not well exposed.
Bear in mind that all this is before the days of photoelectric exposure meters.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to learn to know what your light was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a matter of vast experience.
And development, they do a lot of development by inspection, too?
Most of the old-timers did develop by inspection because they were using an autochromatic film that would not be fogged by red light.
Uh-huh.
And it took a great many negatives for you to learn to develop by inspection because you held the negative up to a safe light and looked through it. And it always appeared more dense because of the undeveloped silver that was in the emulsion.
Uh-huh.
It made it appear more dense, so it took a great deal of exposure. Metal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them would take a piece of tape and put it on the face of the safe light, maybe as big as a postage stamp.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would compare this opaque spot in the safe light to the highlights of the negative. When the highlights got to be as dense as the opaque spot on the safe light, then you had just about reached the point where put it in a shortstop and fixed it. But it was one at a time. They were developed in hangars and a 3.5 gallon tank. And when I came to Winstead's, they were using developer that hit the DK50 that had been replenished for 3.5 years.
Sounds like,
and it was brown.
I don't know, but it sounds like Harvey Kettle.
It was brown as strong coffee, and the images with the film base itself was stained by the brown color. I guess this is the first thing that they start out the first developer. And it caused a little hand wringing around there. The commercial man thought that his life was lost when he had to throw out his developer.
Again, the same reference. Speaking of which, I think every camera store in town has people, if they don't own the store, then they work there, who worked for Winstead. I think Bob Knight, work for Winstead?
Well,
he's up in Lakewood.
Yeah, I think he worked for Lee. I didn't know he worked for Winstead.
I thought he did.
Maybe he worked the finishing plant, something like that.
I'm not really sure the details in
general. The Puddle Boys both worked for Winstead in the photo finishing plant.
Uh-huh.
But I don't, it was before World War II, and I don't know whether they worked for downtown Winstead or whether they worked for George. Because
mm-hmm.
both boys went in the service and came back from the service as photographers.
Harvey, I think he knew George anyway.
Yeah, Harvey, I know that the Tuttle boys both knew George.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they worked in the photo finishing business for George. Now, I didn't know the personnel, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about, maybe this is ignorant, about taking pictures at night and how that's changed? I mean, my vision is Matthew Brady and the flash powder, and I never thought about
one. Well, I don't think Matthew Brady had flash powder.
The Winstead did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, up until 1936, when the solar flash bulb was introduced in America, and before that we made exposure, the flash powder. And this again was a matter of experience and judgment. And the more powder, the more flash, the longer, faster, the farther it reached, and the slower it burned. And we're looking at the picture of the Ku Klux Klan here in a field. There must be 150, 200 men here in white robes. And I am sure that they set off at least 3 ounces of flash powder to make that picture.
All in one shot.
All in one puff. You had a bent tray of metal about 2 feet long. And there were various ways of igniting it. Some had a hot wire with a battery. Others had a cap, like the children's cap pistols used to be. And others had a blank, like a shell, like a blank gun would shoot. And you got your camera all set up, opened the shutter, and you had sprinkled the flash powder along this 2 foot long trough and had a handle on it. And you'd best wear a hat, because there was a ball of fire around you that would be 3 or 4 feet in diameter and would well singe your hair if you didn't have a hat on. And you would held this flash powder up above your head and tripped it, however, some with batteries, some with caps, and that ignited the flash powder, which is magnesium powder. And it burned for 10ths to half a second, depending on the amount of flash powder you had. And you spread out the flash powder and more for bigger distance. A short distance, like in a house, something like that, why you use maybe a teaspoonful. But a big open scene like this would probably have somewhere around 3 ounces of flash powder, which was quite a puff. And there's quite a bit of downward movement of your flash pan too. You're holding it up above your head and it would probably kick it down the handle to you. And then you put the slide back in the camera and it was quite dangerous because the pan would be very hot after this explosion. And unless you carry a wire brush and scraped all the burned powder out of the pan and let it cool, some people carelessly would go to make a second exposure, start dumping powder in this pan when it was still hot. They usually end up without one hand, the one that was holding the flash powder. I had two or three acquaintances who had lost their right hand due to the powder flashing back up into the bottle, which carried 4 ounces of flash powder. Another thing we were quite often called to do in the interfere business is to make pictures of stage. And you're going to talk about auditorium illumination on the stage. There's going to be 50 people on the stage, the whole cast picture, we'll say. And you keep backing up with your camera to get the whole thing in. If you weren't cautious, you could back up under a balcony. And in the darkened room, you didn't know you were under a balcony, and you held your flash powder up and singed the underside of the balcony. You also got well singed, and your suit got well burned from burn, because the flash powder would go up and hit the balcony and come out all over you.
The one of the things about flash powder exposure that's interesting, I think, is, and maybe you can confirm this or tell me I'm wrong or something, the directionality of the light is different than, say, modern sorts of strobes. You don't have that same harsh shadow behind.
No, because this was a large flame, maybe 4 feet in diameter. And
so it kind of spread out.
It spread out. You're using a pan about 2 feet long. And it made a great big ball of fire that's some 4 feet in diameter. And it had greater pairing power because you weren't, well, the sharpness that you're speaking of with regular flash is because of the reflector behind it.
Right.
Now you'll have almost like this with a bare bulb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But of course, your bare bulb wouldn't carry anywhere near as far. Mm-hmm. Later on, we had synchronized flash with flash powder, and it was a cartridge that was ignited by a battery hooked to your camera, and then you had a tongue of flame about 6 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
It was a large cartridge. Well, if I said a very flare gun that the Navy uses to shoot flares, it's about 2 inches in diameter, and the cartridge is about 4 inches long, packed with flash powder, and it would ignite and shoot a stream of fire about 4 to 6 feet long. Mm-hmm. And you could synchronize it with a focal plane shutter.
Hot stuff, huh?
Yeah.
How did you end up working for the Times?
Well, I worked for the Kansas City Star up until the time that I came to Long Beach, and then during the war, I was forced into defense work because I had 3 children. I didn't want to go in the Army. So I went to work in the shipyards. And I was a photographer in Hodson Green Haldeman Shipyards, making launching pictures and breaking the champagne bottle and all the rest of the progress pictures of every hull that was being built. And then after the war, Winstead didn't have anything to sell. And there was still a great void of cameras and films and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work for the Press Telegram as a news photographer.
I'd be too long.
Yeah. And it was Press Telegram at that time.
That's what I was going to say, the Press Telegram.
Mm-hmm.
But it was separate.
Mm-hmm. It was owned by Prisk, and I worked with Hiram Melvin, who had been to Los Angeles. Press photographer for the Los Angeles Daily News, and been hired to come down here work for a Press Telegram, and you know, I worked together there until 1948, and then I had an opportunity to go with the Los Angeles Mirror, which started in September 1948, and I worked there for 5 years, and I transferred to the Times.
Is that when the Times took over the Mirror?
Well, the Times owned the Mirror from the very start. And they started the Mirror. It cost them some $15 million or something to start that newspaper. But the Mirror was not well accepted. It was a sort of a Hearst type of reporting, which didn't sit well with the advertisers and people in Los Angeles. And they had at one time a 250,000 circulation. It dropped down to less than 50,000. And so then the Times decided to close it. And so I had already left the Mirror and gone with the Los Angeles Times in the suburban sections. suburban sections you may not or may know of. They are newspapers published by the Times, under the Times banner, in a particular area. Here in Long Beach, we have one that covers from Whittier to Wilmington, I think, and Compton and Bell Gardens and Huntington Park and all area, in other words, it's the southeast section of Los Angeles County. And we started one for Orange County, and I think I have 8 of them now. San Diego County, Orange County, and then there's 4 or 5 here in Los Angeles County. So I worked with that until 1974. I retired.
And so you saw a lot of technical changes in photography during that time also.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we saw a great deal of change in photography from the old days of the speed graphic. Of course, when I worked in Kansas City, I worked with flash powder. I'm one of the few people who have worked with flash powder. And of course, then we went with graphics up until 1953. We started using Rotoflexes. We started in the suburban section with Rotoflexes because we had a problem with sending pictures back to the office. And you had all these holders, and you'd have 8 assignments a day, maybe 4 or 5 pictures on each assignment. And it would be a real problem just to transport that many holders and to load that many holders, so we started using a Rolleiflex camera to roll film. And we could send in 3 or 4 rolls of film with a whole day's work on it. And then later, the rest of the newspapers went with the Rolleiflex for a while. And then we got into 35mm through the sports department. We were using, when Nikon first came out, it was a rangefinder camera and not particularly different than the other camera. And then the Nikon came out with a reflex camera that you could use long telephoto lenses with. And then a little later they brought out a motor for it that would drive the camera rapidly, or maybe 4 or 5 pictures a minute. And but the cameras weren't designed to be driven by a motor. At one time we had 35 cameras and motors just for the sports department. We'd have 8 or 10 in New York and 3 or 4 here in local repair shops, and maybe 15 to or from Japan being repaired. And
that was the old app?
Yeah. The F camera, and the camera wasn't designed, the gears and whole mechanism wasn't designed to be driven that rapidly as the motor would drive it. And so then we had the great inventory of long telephoto lenses and things like that, so we just stayed with Nikon as they improved the camera and they improved the... Originally they had a long battery pack that held 10 1.5 volt batteries of C cells, which were about the poorest quality of dry batteries, and cords that would break. You go to a football game with 5 or 6 cords to connect your battery to your camera, and you'd also have maybe 36 batteries taken with you just in case some of them went down on you. Well, we fellows there developed the capacitor start. They put little pencil batteries in a pack with a capacitor which charged, and when you pressed the button to start it, while the capacitor fired a burst of electricity to start the motor moving. And it was much easier more sure to be started, more sure to run. Mm-hmm. That developed the motor drive. And since then, of course, Nikon became the most prominent camera in the
But you don't own any.
Hmm?
You don't have one, do you?
No, I had that experience with 35 cameras in inventory, and not. Sometimes we would pray that we could get through a football game with two cameras. That's all we had. No, I don't have any Nikons.
Did you do sports photography?
Oh, yes.
Were you jack of all trades, or did you specialize in?
No, there were certain people who had maybe a little more verve in sports or something like that, and you would do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they would direct that you send McLean on the horse races or something like that, mm-hmm. or football. Mm-hmm. The sports part would require certain photographers. They're still that way. They still have certain photographers who do sports. Mm-hmm. And do other things. But many of the sports photographers are not adept at handling society or handling food photography or
mm-hmm.
portraiture or something like that.
Yeah, how did you get into photographing society?
This was assigned. The boss says, you go and do this assignment, and hands it to you.
You look well dressed today. Good.
Yeah. Well, it was a dictate that photographer for the time shall wear a white shirt, a necktie, and a jacket.
Mm-hmm.
No t-shirts.
Was it that way at the Press Telegram also?
Yes. Well, I mean,
up until recently.
Well, I mean, when you worked there.
Yeah, when I worked there, yes. We dressed in business suits. It wasn't a dictate. It was more or less expected of everybody dressed that way.
Now I think it's kind of a dictate that if you're a photographer, you're supposed to look something like an animal.
Yeah, you have to have a beard and a pot belly with a t-shirt that has some obscene expression on it.
What kind of things did you take pictures with when you worked for the Press Telegram?
News. All kinds of news. A lot of it was set up where you went down to photograph the mayor and some proclamation or something or other. I think that when one time there I had a running assignment every day to photograph the mayor, I think for something like 5 weeks. Every morning I had an assignment to the city hall to make a picture of the mayor or whatever situation. He was always making proclamations or visiting or playing with pride.
Or one of the standard pictures is known as the Grip and Grin.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Grip and Grin, or Pass a Gavel. And a three men with a piece of paper.
Or the hero shot, right?
Yeah.
Which would be in a company, I mean, Secretary of the Year or Councilman of the Month.
Yeah. Of course, a check padding is always a standard bromide, too, and it's a terrible thing to make. One time, someone was giving $500 to some charity or other. I went down to five merchant bank, and I got $500
mm-hmm.
and took it and stacked it up on the table just to get away from the check passing.
Good for you.
That days you could get silver dollars.
You think, and I don't know how much this applies to newspaper work, but I've done work for some big companies in which I think that my presence there with a camera and a flash is more important than the product, more important than the print that will come out of it. What I mean is there's a certain sense that there are going to be some important people within the company there, and they want the public relations department wants to let them know that they think, hey, this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they shoot so they have a photographer show up. It's more to lend an official air.
It's
harder to get the newspaper to come down and do that for you,
yeah.
Unless you can bend a few arms.
The number of photographers are limited on the newspaper, and fixed assignments many times interfere. And public relations men are always twisting the CEO to his arm for a check passing or something like that, or three men a piece of paper, or three women a piece of paper. And so, but to ameliorate the people who dropped everything and came down to pose, the PR men have hire a commercial photographer to come and
mm-hmm.
do the honors on the local press, and they many times will submit the pictures to the press, and if they have enough leverage, they can get it in. But I know city editors many, many more times than not get some society dame on the phone or some prominent sacred cow in town, and she's demanding that the photographer come to make a picture of whatever it is. And the city editor will send the photographer on one of these nonsense pictures just to get her off the phone.
And then never run it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we didn't have space.
That's right.
Couldn't work that in.
Yeah. It's a very, very common thing for the city editor to do that. And it costs the city editor at least $50 to send somebody out there.
So, again, an aside, this PR guy I talked to at one of these companies told me that some higher up called him to set up a date for some luncheon or something. They wanted a photographer and told him to hire somebody to come down. And he said, oh, that's so boring, you know, and he sort of forgot about it. He said, I don't want to do it anyway, but he sort of forgot about it. So the day came and no photographer showed up. And a day or so later, they called him and said, hey, Bob, did you hire a photographer for this job? And he says, I sure did. Didn't he show up? And they said, no. And he said, well, I'll never hire him again.
Yeah, that happens very many times. One time, not too long ago, Jasper Nutter had some kind of a deal. I don't know what it was. One of the heart or lung associations or something like that. Jasper's going to be out of town. So he called me and said, would you go over and shoot the thing for me? I'll be gone. So it was some 3 or 4 weeks in advance when he called me. So I called the guy about 4 different times, and he would never answer the phone, and I left a message with his girl for him to call me. I wanted to talk over what he wanted and how many people were involved and so on. You know, I never did get a call on that guy, and yet there was a big hoorah because no photographer showed up, but yet he wouldn't return the call.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go. I didn't have an address. All I knew was one of these do-good associations that, so I didn't know what was coming out. But I called him, I think, 4 times within the week prior to the date.
Yeah, in the Inman books, you can see that occasionally they sold pictures to the Times or the Examiner. Or
mm-hmm.
Under what circumstances would they do that?
Well, at that time, well, I guess today they don't even have a photographer down here. And if Inman was covering it, he would probably shoot an extra film and send it to the newspaper, each one. Or maybe they would call him. I know many times they will call a commercial photographer and have him shoot a picture when they can't get someone down, particularly some distance away. Hmm. And many times, it used to be in the old days when they went out with a tripod and even had a camera. One of the early books about how to be a city editor cautions the city editor to crop the heart out of a picture. In other words, a commercial man would set up his camera and take a general view, but that wasn't the important part. The important part was probably in the very center of the picture, and the rest of it was extraneous. And we had a new city editor here on the Press Telegram, a man who had been a church editor before. And so he'd been reading that book, and I could see from week to week how he was reading that book, how he was getting along. Finally, one day, they had a raid out here on the gambling boat. Tony Canera had a gambling boat off the breakwater. And so I went out with the raid group, and I made a picture back showing the federal agents, 3 of them, were vaulting over the hand railing of the boat, up in the air. And, of course, it showed the boat I was on and this boat, the gambling ship. And that particular day, the editor had been reading this particular passage about cropping the center out. So I end up with one federal agent with his coattails flapping as he vaulted the ship rail. You couldn't tell what in the world was going on, except there was a man in the air with his hand on a pipe. And his coattails were flapping. Just from the old days when they sent a commercial man out who stood up and made a general view.
Well, and creative captioning for all that, then, right?
Well, yeah, I was talking about a raid on Punta Canal's boat.
Ken has primarily talked about 8x10 negatives.
Uh-huh.
But in the Inman collection, I guess that's all we have of Winston's.
Yeah, I've never seen any.
No, I don't think there was anything. I think Brown, when he quit, retired or whatever, I don't know.
He did the portrait.
No, McIntyre did the portrait. And Brown did the commercial the last 2 or 3 years. And they were still shooting the 10 camera.
Mm-hmm.
And a hand flash. Not synchronized, just a hand flash.
Hmm.
But Inman, I think, started using the graphic 4 or 5 view camera early in... Well, probably pre-war too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are 4x5 film negatives and 4x5 glass negatives. And then there's another size of glass negative that's bigger.
5x7.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the glass negative, well, I don't know if Larry, well, he was a newspaper man at any time or not. I don't know that much about his early years. Newspapers used glass negatives up until 1936. Well, yeah, I think about 36. Because they could print them when they were wet. The glass was rigid, and you could dry the back of the glass, the front side was an image, and gelatin, it was still wet. And you could put that in an enlarger and make a print right away without waiting for the film to dry. A plate to dry would take all night, practically. And so they used for speed purposes, and then we also had more sensitive plates than there was film. The films were quite slow. And we had plates that are much more sensitive than there was in film. These plates were made in Germany for the most part. All I remember using was Crest 3000, which had a very heavy annihilation in the emulsion, which was a brown opaque dye which kept the light from being scattered by the glass. And but they were quite some 3 times more sensitive than the fastest film. So we used that. I remember the first film I ever shot was a Picard balloon. Picard was a Swiss scientist who was working in cosmic rays, and he went up from South Dakota in a helium balloon to record cosmic rays, and he was in a sphere about 4 or 5 feet in diameter, and he drifted from South Dakota down into Nebraska, and something happened to the balloon. It lost its helium gas and crashed in a cornfield in Nebraska, and I flew up there in a small airplane and made pictures of the field and landed, and we made pictures of this gondola, a sphere about, was cracked open like an Easter egg. And Picard, I think, had bailed out in a parachute and landed right close by, but he was standing around looking at the pieces and so forth. And that was the first time I ever used film on assignment. And unfortunately, the plane I was in was grounded at sundown, and we couldn't fly back. But the opposition had come up in the TWA plane, which had lights and could fly at night. So they all went into town to have supper at sundown, and I always have had a changing bag, which was a black bag it's dark on the inside, completely closed up. And I sit down there and change my film out of the holders into a paper box, in a film box, and tape the box shut. And I went up into the pilot's compartment, and I tipped his seat up, and I put the box of film and taped it in the springs of the pilot's seat. Put the cushion back, put the guy's trench coat over it, got back on the field while they were in town having dinner. And they all come back and wish me goodbye, and I try to give them my box of holders, and they wouldn't take them. And so then as soon as they got airborne and I hitchhiked into town, there were a lot of people out there. The poor man's cornfield was just stomped to death, just flattened, and called the office and told them where the films were. So they sent a copy boy down, and no one knew, office boy or copy boy. And he went in, told him the number of the plane, and when the plane had been put in the hangar, he went in and went over and lifted the seat and got the box of film, went back to the office, and they developed them and printed them. It was the first time I ever used sheet film.
That was great.
It was in their plate holders, too. I had to take them out of the septums and put them in the holder. And put them in a box. But it was...
plate holders are thicker than film holders?
Yes.
And is that the main difference?
The main difference, and they also have room for a plate. They had a little clip that clipped the edge of the plate. A little metal clip that held a glass plate down.
I've never worked with those at all.
No. And yet, you could tell a photographer, he always had cuts on his fingers from holding the edge of the glass plate while he dried it.
There aren't any glass Wednesdays that you've seen.
Oh, no, I haven't seen any. I imagine there probably are some, though.
I don't know. I never knew. As I said, I never got into the Winstead commercial end of it. It was moribund when I was there. Looking for an Eastman publication that just came. Have you seen this thing yet?
We also haven't seen any. Have you seen any portraits that were done by Mr. McInturk,
yeah.
McInturk?
I don't know of anyone but I know he had a studio. I have seen some portraits that he had on display, but and they were the soft focus and retouched extensively and quite arty. And there were a portrait of a young man with lapels that come clear down to here, a white silk shirt on with long lapels. And not lapels, but here, you want to turn your tape off now?
Winston, you went out and photographed every Navy ship.
Oh, yes, with a postcard camera, postcard size. That's 3.25 by 5.5. And I did the picture from broadside in order to show all the rigging and everything on the ship. And we had a tremendous sale for sailors to buy pictures of their ship to send home. And the purpose was to show the ship in entirety. Winstead's did an enormous amount of photography of scenes around Long Beach. The new auditorium when it was built. I mean, the auditorium, not the Terrace Theater and so forth, which is recent.
What I think of is the auditorium.
Yeah. palms and the oceanfront and... crowded beaches, things like that were a big sale to tourists.
What, as in the form of photographs?
In the form of photographic postcards.
Oh, I see. He would
black and white postcards.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time of the earthquake, the Winstead store was and finishing plant was damaged, and the walls broken and so forth, so they could not work there. And so George took the postcard camera and went out and photographed all sorts of street scenes in Long Beach, showing all the damaged buildings and all the debris in the streets and the crushed cars and the fire department cleaning and rescuing people and things like that. I don't know, probably 150 negatives that he made. And they went to Frasher, which is a photographic place in Pomona. And Frasher had a big finishing plant, and Frasher did an enormous business in Southern California in black and white photographs of, we'll say, date gardens, and Palm Springs, and desert scenes, and all kinds of things like that. He had thousands of negatives of Southern California. And so Frasher printed these postcards by the thousands. And so the Winstead brothers set up two sawhorses, or maybe six sawhorses, on the front and the sidewalk in front of the store with some planks across it, and sold these earthquake pictures as postcards to people on the street who came along gawking, and tourists and anybody else who wanted the pictures. They're still around. I see them every once in a while. And these photographs, they made enough money. I think they sold them for 10 cents a piece. They made enough money to restore all of the damaged laboratory and the store and everything else out of the sale of earthquake pictures.
Uh-huh.
And even after I went there, I went several times to photograph different news events. Well, one time Franklin Roosevelt came to town and was in an open car. I made a picture of him, and I guess we sold 200-300 pictures of Franklin Roosevelt. And another time, Wrong Way Corrigan started from Long Beach on his wrong way flight.
Mm.
And he was duplicating Lindbergh's trip to Europe. But the city put a monument out in the runway where he took off from in Long Beach Airport. And so he was here, and Corrigan was here to unveil that, and I made pictures of that. And we sold probably a couple of hundred pictures of Romney Corrigan, and the plaque was busily on the airport runway. Of course, it's gone now, probably in the city. It was a bronze tablet, about 18 by 20 inches, something like that. And it's probably in the city yard someplace. They took it up.
Let's, you know, that sort of activity is different. I don't think anyone does that sort of thing with photographs anymore.
No, no. Because it takes an outlet for it, where people are downtown and to see it. And, but I did a great many things like that. As I said, I photographed all the Navy ships in different times. And when a new ship, a new carrier, aircraft carrier, something would come in, I had to go out in a shoreboat and make photographs of it because we had demand for it. And even the ship stores would buy the pictures by the hundreds and for all the sailors on the ship to send home.
Where did all these postcard companies come from? I mentioned postcards earlier, and a friend of mine who had a lot of pictures. Some of them are printed in Germany, but there it is. It's like Pine Avenue, 1930 mm-hmm. or 1916 mm-hmm. or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
But printed in Wisconsin or Germany, some of them in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Well, there are still today Dexter postcard company here in the United States. I think there's one of them in Los Angeles that if you make a 4x5 transparency, they will print the cards, 1,000 of them, I think, for $75
mm-hmm.
in color, high chrome color, too. And you go around and sell them and put them in the stores to be sold.
I see. But isn't the distribution... I had a feeling that these were actually distributed by these various companies. And
Well, it's no doubt had a salesman who came around and filled the racks and did, or mm-hmm. or you ordered them from the manufacturer and filled the racks, because there used to be a big business here on the drugstores, had a rack maybe 5 feet wide and 3 feet high of postcards, colored postcards for you to buy, and you go traveling, you'll see them all over.
You can still buy your colored postcard of the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Save on probably for about a quarter, something like that.
Something like that.
35 cents. But these were different. They were